For, I don't usually do such personal indulgences, but as I mentioned, that little cat has been with us for 15 years. She died 3 days ago, and she was sitting there as I was preparing this presentation, so that's why I put her picture there. You'll forgive me, I hope. Anyhow, I'm not to talk about that. I'm here to talk about Pioneer 10 and 11 and the infamous anomaly. And as John mentioned, these two spacecraft were launched in 1972 and 1973. And they were the first two deep space craft that went beyond the orbit of Mars, explored Jupiter, and beyond. These spacecraft were designed for an original mission duration of 600 to 900 days. Their primary objectives were to study the asteroid belt, or actually fly through the asteroid belt and prove that it is possible for spacecraft to survive that environment, make close-up observations of Jupiter, and there were some secondary objectives, including exploration of the outer solar system and searching for gravity waves and searches for planet X, which is no longer the 10th planet if it exists, because Pluto has been demoted, but at the time it was. And the idea was that these two spacecraft can actually be used for high-precision orbit determination and can be used as such to detect small gravitational anomalies in the outer solar system. This is what these guys looked like. They were actually very, very simple spacecraft. They weighed about 250 kilograms each. They had electrical power on board supplied by four radioisotope thermoelectric generators powered by plutonium. Each spacecraft had about 150 watts of electrical power available at the time of launch, and this was, of course, decreasing over time as the spacecraft was aging and the plutonium fuel was decaying, and also the efficiency of the thermocouples that were in the generators was also going down, both as a result of thermocouple decay and also as a result of the decreasing temperature difference between the outside and the inside. They had a close to 3-meter wide antenna and an 8-watt transmitter that they used to communicate back to the Earth at these data rates. And most importantly, they were spin stabilized. I will explain why that's important. So this diagram shows the orbits of Pioneer 10 and 11. I'm going through this part quick, by the way, because I'm pretty sure that you're familiar with some or all of these details. Pioneer 10 went and visited Jupiter in December 1973 and then continued outward from the solar system. Pioneer 11 had a much more interesting orbit because it made a very close encounter with Jupiter in December 1974. And this huge gravitational assist was sufficient for it to essentially make a right turn and fly all the way across the solar system for an encounter with Saturn in September 1979. This is another pretty picture, more three-dimensional, showing Pioneer 10 and 11 and Voyagers 1 and 2 as well. And it kind of puts it into a little bit of context in terms of the solar system and its motion in the interstellar environment. So I mentioned spin. Pioneer 10 and 11 were spinning, and spin was what allowed the spacecraft to keep their high-gain antennas oriented towards the Earth. And that meant that very, very few maneuvers were required to keep the spacecraft Earth-oriented. And that's the main reason why we have such clean data from Pioneer 10 and 11, because in the later parts of their mission, they had as few as 2 maneuvers per year. And that meant that for months at that time, they were flying completely undisturbed by maneuvers and the associated uncertainties and also gas leaks that occur after maneuvers. The maneuvers themselves were actually quite interesting. They were called con-scan or conical scan maneuvers. And the idea was, this is like you have to think back to 1969 when these spacecraft were designed. In 1969, how do you achieve the capability for a spacecraft like this to be able to autonomously home in on a signal from the Earth? And it's absolutely ingenious, because what they do, they have a piston that actually moves the horn of the high-gain antenna and displaces it from the center. If you think about the parabolic antenna and something at the focal point, if it is displaced but the antenna is perfectly oriented at you, even though the antenna rotates as a result of the spacecraft spinning, the received signal will still be at a constant level. But if it is displaced, if it is not oriented properly, then you introduce a sinusoidal modulation. And there, a very simple analog computer was on board that was integrating the sinusoidal modulation and timed the thruster firings to do a precession maneuver to orient the spacecraft that towards the Earth. It's so beautiful. I mean, this is pre-computer era. There were no computers on board. The electronics on board was about 150 TTL level chips, each with a few logic gates per chip. That was it. So Pioneer 10 worked all the way up to about 80 astronomical units from the Earth, with a round-trip light time of 21 hours. It was moving at approximately 12 kilometers per second relative to the sun, and it, as far as we know, it is still doing that and will continue doing that for many thousands of years. After 30 years, Pioneer 10 was actually last contacted in 2003, so it actually operated 31 years. And at the end of that, one instrument was still operating on board, but the spacecraft was power-starved. Because the, as a result of the decay of the onboard fuel, onboard power supply, the available power was now less than 60 watts. It was no longer sufficient to maintain the nominal voltage on the main bus of the spacecraft. So essentially, all systems were collapsing. It's a near miracle that it was still capable of communication. One other attempt was made to communicate with the spacecraft in early 2006, I believe, but that attempt was not successful because for all we know, the transmitter no longer had sufficient power on board to operate. This is a very important statement, that's why I put it in such large letters. Pioneer 10 and 11 are the most precisely navigated spacecraft to date, and they are unparalleled. And that's why we have the ability to do the kind of precision study that made detection of the Pioneer anomaly possible. This anomalous acceleration was first sort of observed in the 1980s when navigators were getting wrong solutions. And it was eventually confirmed by several researchers, and the big question became, what is its cause? Is it caused by something on board, I said mechanical, or is it something that is an indication of new physics? Needless to say, it would be absolutely wonderful if it was new physics, because that means that it is possible to do observational studies of new physics using relatively ordinary spacecraft in the solar system. In the papers that have been published up to and including the big 2002 paper published by JPL, relatively limited stretches of navigational data were studied. And the reason for that, of course, is because they had to go back decades to recover some old data and do these studies. Since 2002, we have recovered a lot more data, and some of what I'm going to talk to you about is basically results and work in progress using the newer data set, the more up-to-date data set, which basically expanded our the amount of available data by a factor of two. So we now have over 20 years of Pioneer 10 data and over 10 years of Pioneer 11 data, which is more than twice what there used to be and what was used as the basis of the 2002 study.
One question, is this free data, or because you're involved in a collaboration, can you see?
It's not yet public data, but I believe that the intent is that all Pioneer 10 and 11 data will be made available to researchers through the what's the name, the NASA data service, PDS? PDS, I'm not, Planetary, yeah, PDS, Planetary Data Service, I forgot the acronym. But, there's the big NASA website where all the raw data from missions are available, and the plan is that eventually all the navigational data and all the telemetry data from Pioneer 10 and 11 will be available. They are not currently available publicly. So, as I indicated, the search for basically, the gravitational experiment in deep space for Pioneer and 11 began in 1979. This is how the anomaly got detected first in 1980. There was an analysis in 1990 through 1995 that was the main basis of the initial publication in 1998 of the Physical Review Letters paper that announced the Pioneer anomaly. In 2002, Craig Marquardt from NASA Goddard independently confirmed the Pioneer anomaly using software that he developed. In 2005, Øystein Olsen from Norway confirmed the Pioneer anomaly, and in 2009, I confirmed the Pioneer anomaly again using independently developed orbit determination software. That is important in the sense that it basically shows that different people using completely different approaches and completely different independently developed software were able to say that, yes, we get the same result. So there is really no doubt that the anomaly exists. What the question is its possible cause. Is cause or causes and that research. The Pioneer anomaly can be interpreted in a number of ways. The conventional interpretation is that it is an acceleration, because that's the most obvious reason why there would be an anomalous Doppler shift in the data. What we can think of... I'm going to. Just bear with me a few. I'm actually going to elaborate on that point, because I think that's a very important question. These are the interpretations of the anomaly. So we can interpret the anomaly as an acceleration. We can interpret the anomaly as a possible clock drift or frequency drift. Again, acceleration or velocity change is the most conventional interpretation. And for spacecraft engineers, the number is very small. But from a gravitational physics perspective, this is a huge number, because it is several orders of magnitude beyond the PPM corrections, for instance. So this is definitely a non-relativistic effect that shows up at the Newtonian level. So by 2006, and I chose that particular date because that's when I became much more seriously involved in the research of the Pioneer anomaly, this was pretty much the consensus that the Pioneer anomaly is real, and up to that date, all attempts to offer a conventional explanation failed. So there was a good possibility that it may actually be due to new physics, and that generated, of course, a lot of interest. And there were many alternatives proposed to explain the Pioneer anomaly. I just listed a few of them: gravity modification, dark matter, cosmology, the infamous coincidence that the apparent acceleration of the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft happens to have the same, never mind the same numerical magnitude, almost the same numerical value as C times H naught. And that, of course, prompted a number of people to propose ideas that the anomaly may, in fact, be a manifestation of the cosmic expansion or something else. So I was already involved, sort of, with Pioneer in 2003, because I was actually working with Larry Kellogg, who was one of the last custodians of the Pioneer project, in the recovery of the telemetry data. But it was in 2005 that I first met Slava Turyshev, who is the lead researcher of the Pioneer anomaly at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And I must tell you, I was absolutely astonished when Slava told me that up to that date, there was no detailed thermal model of the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft. I was astonished because, well, the thermal hypothesis, namely that the acceleration or some of the acceleration may be due to anisotropically emitted heat on board the spacecraft, has been around since forever. Has been around in later responses to the initial PRL publication in 1998. Has been mentioned in the 2002 paper. So,
by the way, 2002 paper, I understand, was the longest paper ever published, physical review up to that time.
So I was told, yes. Something like 50 pages.
50 pages.
Yeah. So I must say, I was astonished when Slava told me that no detailed thermal model, mathematical thermal model, exists of the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft. I also became quite interested, because that meant, you know, like something meaningful to do. Why is it important? I mentioned the RTGs on board. These RTGs produce up to 2.5 kilowatts of thermal power, most of which is radiated into space as waste heat, because the thermocouples that convert it into electricity are very inefficient, only a few percent efficient. So out of the 2.5 kilowatts, we get 160 watts of electrical power. The rest is just heat. Not to mention that 160 watts then goes into the instruments, where it is converted into heat, because in the end, that's what computers do. They convert electricity into heat. And the Pioneer spacecraft was no different. So other than the energy that is radiated away in the form of its radio beam, all other forms of energy generated on board will be radiated away as heat. Now, the thing is that to produce the anomalous acceleration of Pioneer 10 and 11, all you need is about 65 watts of directed heat. So if I have a small, plus 2.5% anisotropy on one side, minus 2.5% anisotropy on the other side, that's sufficient to produce the Pioneer anomaly. And you saw the diagram. The Pioneer spacecraft is not spherically symmetric. So some anisotropy is obviously there. Question is how much. And the big problem is that when you try to build a thermal model, especially if it is an unsophisticated model, there are approximations, because there are so many unknowns, you know, material properties, exact surface geometry, etc., etc. And the anisotropy is essentially the difference between two quantities, like heat radiated into one direction versus heat radiated into another direction. And the difference is two orders of magnitude smaller than the numbers that you're estimating in the first place. So that means that any error in the model would be absolutely magnified, which means that accuracy is essential, that you cannot do back-of-the-envelope Pioneer calculations because your calculations have to be good at the less than 1% level in order to be able to make meaningful statements about the thermal contribution to the acceleration of the Pioneer spacecraft. But it is also very difficult to be accurate, because we are talking about spacecraft that were designed in 1969, constructed by 1971, launched in 1972 and 1973, and whatever documentation survived into the 21st century, a lot of it was literally, I saw it with my own eyes, was in the dumpster, and saved from the dumpster because people knew that, hey, Larry, I thought you were interested in Pioneer stuff. I saved this for you. I saw that with my own eyes, that particular incident. So it's very difficult, but it is possible. In part because of the efforts of this Larry Kellogg, whom I mentioned several times, the entire telemetry record of the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft is saved. And when I say telemetry record, everything that these two spacecraft radioed back to the Earth and everything that the Deep Space Network added to that, like signal strength measurements, et cetera, is saved. We have some gaps in that data. In particular, the most notable gap is that the Pioneer, the Jupiter encounter of Pioneer 10 is completely missing. Obviously, someone borrowed those tapes decades ago and never returned them, so they were never converted to other media and they are lost. But other than that, everything else is saved. So we basically have an essentially complete record of the telemetry on board. The telemetry on board is low resolution, but it is very redundant because it gives us a lot of details about how much electrical power was produced, how much electrical power was consumed, and that can be validated because we also have a whole bunch of temperature readings on board from a variety of temperature sensors. These were engineering sensors. They were designed to monitor the health of the spacecraft, but the data is still there. And now if we try to construct a detailed thermal model of the spacecraft, we can use these data to validate that model. So what we are trying to do is not prove or disprove the quote-unquote thermal hypothesis. We don't want to say, no, it can't be heat, or yes, it is heat. We try to account for the heat, because the heat is there. You can't ignore it. I believe I actually said, yeah. We cannot ignore conventional physics. You cannot say, you know, I'm not interested in the heat, but because it's conventional physics, we know it's proven, it exists. You have to account for it. Whether it is 10% of the anomaly or 120% of the anomaly, that's the question, but it is there, and it cannot be ignored. So I'm again, using capital letters to make this statement, because all too often I saw papers or heard comments where basically people were thinking in this either-or mindset. You know, it's either thermal or something else. No, it's most likely it is thermal and maybe something else, in addition, not in place of. So if you aren't convinced, let me convince you why, one more time, why the thermal hypothesis is important. That's plutonium dioxide. That's what it looks like. It's internal heat. That's radioactive decay. It's that hot. Spontaneous decay. This case has been made in 1998. I believe that within months of the original JPL publication, two researchers, Murphy and Cutts, proposed somewhat overlapping explanations, but they were the ones who initially said, you know, like, first of all, there is all the heat produced by these RTGs. How is that heat being emitted? In what direction is that heat being emitted from the spacecraft? And second, there is all that electrical power that is produced on board. What direction is that being emitted? But the problem is that these are back-of-the-envelope arguments and dismissed as such. To do it the right way, you have to actually do the details. You have to recover all the data, and you have to build as detailed a model as possible. This is why the argument by Murphy and Cutts, and also Lou Scheffer, who wrote a very comprehensive paper in 2003, and that was published in Physical Review D. He actually was the first one who really methodically went through all possible heat sources on board and tried to quantify them and added it all up, and he actually found that they actually amount to more than 100% of the anomaly. But these were all dismissed. They were dismissed as back-of-the-envelope calculations, and they were dismissed using back-of-the-envelope arguments. Like, I've seen arguments that, you know, when I calculated that, you know, the angle of sight of the antenna is so small, it cannot be that. Scheffer is wrong. So, in other words, the arguments on both sides were really not substantiated with the necessary background work to do the level of detailed analysis that is necessary to have an unambiguous answer. Yes?
What about the 2002 paper, the 50-page paper?
2002 paper, again, had used the back of the envelope argument to dismiss the thermal hypothesis. So this is the easy part, because we know exactly what is on board that can generate heat. The radioisotope thermoelectric generators, I used the figure 100 watts. As I said, it started off as 160 watts. Towards the end of the mission, it was all the way down to like 56 watts. But order of magnitude, 100 watts of electrical heat. There was an additional about 10 watts worth of tiny radioisotope heater units, just a few milligrams of plutonium. I'm not sure exactly how much plutonium, tiny amount of plutonium. These were placed at strategic locations to prevent, for instance, from, fuel lines from freezing. And there was a tremendous amount of heat produced by the propulsion system when it was operating, but that heat was transient, and it is basically eaten up by the propulsion system noise when we don't know the exact duration of a thruster pulse. There's always fuel leaks afterwards. So whatever heat was produced there, the recoil force due to that heat being radiated away is dwarfed by all the other uncertainties that are present in maneuvers already. So this part can be safely ignored. These three cannot. They have to be accounted for. This is what these RTGs look like. And that's how much plutonium was on board each spacecraft. That's a huge amount of heat. So I refer you back to that picture of that glowing plutonium dioxide pellet. I mean, we had 4.6 kilograms of that yellow-white glowing stuff on board. And this is, of course, the essence of the thermal argument, that you have a spacecraft that is highly asymmetric. You have a spacecraft body, which is generating about 100 watts of electrical heat. And at the bottom of that body, there is a louver system, a thermal dissipation louver system, which was designed to maintain relatively constant internal temperatures at various distances from the sun. So that louver system, even when it was fully closed, still had a much higher effective emissivity than all the other parts of this body, which were covered by multilayer insulation. So that means that all the heat that's generated in here, or almost all the heat that's generated in here, would be radiated in this direction. With respect to the RTGs would radiate heat in all directions, but some of that heat might hit the high-gain antenna and be reflected, again, preferentially in this direction. So that's the essence of the thermal argument. If these arrows together amount to 65 watts of heat, then there is no anomaly, because it's a thermal recoil force effect that simply hasn't been accounted for when the anomaly was first detected. The spin actually makes the calculations easy, because the spacecraft is spinning. Any component of the thermal recoil force that is perpendicular to the spin axis can be safely ignored. And the reason for that is that the spin rate is much higher than any rate of change that might occur in the thermal forces. Therefore, any perpendicular component simply averages to zero. There's another aspect of it that actually makes calculations somewhat simpler. And I have to emphasize, these are not back-of-the-envelope arguments. This is actually something that can be substantiated by doing it properly. Namely, that at the temperatures on board and at the thermal power and thermal sources, given the thermal sources that are on board, we find that the recoil force is pretty much a homogeneous and linear function of the power of the onboard thermal sources. And in particular, you can actually aggregate those into just two numbers, the heat of the radioisotope generators and the electrical heat that is produced within the main spacecraft body. This relationship can be postulated, but it can also be verified by doing a detailed thermal model and then running that detailed thermal model at various points in the spacecraft's history and verifying whether or not indeed these constant coefficients are present, and we find that they are. So it actually makes life simpler. I put it here because it is usually at this point when I give this explanation that some people say, you know, like, wait a moment, I was told that the pioneer anomaly is constant and sunward, and you're talking about heat here that is decaying with time. And in any case, even if it were constant, it would not be pointing in the direction of the sun. So how can that be? And this is where I come to the first misconception that I would like to dispel, and that is that we all heard that the pioneer anomaly is a constant sunward acceleration. And that's not true. That's not the Pioneer anomaly. And I'm going to answer your question in a moment now. Because acceleration is not the observable. This is not the Pioneer anomaly, no matter how many times you saw it. This is not the Pioneer anomaly. And this is not the Pioneer anomaly. These are all manifestations of the anomaly or interpretations of the anomaly, but the Pioneer anomaly begins here. And it is this when it should have been this. These are the Doppler residuals. This is a best fit Doppler residual. This is Hertz, you know, like we are talking about 50 millihertz here, 50 millihertz here. 20, this is, I believe, 17-year time span. And this is not a very good fit. But when we introduce the constant acceleration, the fit substantially improves. And this is how we know that something is wrong, because without an additional assumption, no matter how we tweak the model, we just don't get any a fit that is better than this. And if you actually look at it, you can see these peaks are basically solar conjunction when the spacecraft signal is traveling through the solar plasma, which is very difficult to model. But in addition to that, you actually see discontinuities like this, and when you actually analyze this, what happens? This is a maneuver. And the fitting software actually used the maneuver, giving it an unrealistically large amount of velocity change, trying to absorb the badness of this fit that occurs for other reasons. Now, if I keep my finger here and switch to the next one, back, that disappeared. Now we have a much better fit, and the fitting software is no longer trying to abuse the maneuvers and absorb into the maneuvers a problem that is occurring due to some other cause. So I'm emphasizing that if you want to know what the Pioneer anomaly is an unrealistically large Doppler residual, which we know is not as good as we should be able to get. Everything else is interpretation, explanation, if you wish. I'm saying the same thing here. Now, another thing about it is that the Pioneer anomaly was initially detected by JPL navigators. Their job is not to do fundamental physics. Their job is to navigate the spacecraft. Basically, find out where the spacecraft is, find out where the spacecraft will be the next day. So they are trying to fix a navigational problem without regard to the physical causes of that navigational problem. So they find that when they introduce a constant acceleration, which their software allowed them to do, the problem goes away. So they introduce that. But that doesn't mean that that's the only possible explanation. In fact, a temporally decaying acceleration model also fits the data. An earthward acceleration model also fits the data and reduces the residuals to the expected level. An earthward and temporally decaying model also fits the data, again, reducing the Doppler residuals to the required level. And many other possibilities are there. So I wish to emphasize that the data is the Doppler, the anomaly is the large residuals, and the solution is whatever it takes to reduce those residuals to where they are supposed to be in the first place, and the constant sunward acceleration does solve the problem, but it is not a unique solution. So when we compare solutions, what we need to compare is not, or we compare theory, for instance, what we need to compare a theory against is not 8.74 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. What we need to compare a theory to is the Doppler residual. When you put that theory into the model, for instance, changing the spacecraft force model using a hypothetical force, and rerun the model, does it reduce the residual? So in a sense, if you have a physical model that suggests that there is an acceleration of the right magnitude, that's a good sanity check, but that's not proof. The proof is that you then plug that model into the orbital model of the Pioneer spacecraft, rerun the orbital model, calculate the residuals, and find out whether or not it works. Now, you notice that even the good fit was still plenty noisy. And there are many possible noise sources, some of which are basically random measurement noise, you know, like deep space network clock noise, clock uncertainties, some of which are systematic noises, either because our understanding of the solar system is not as perfect as we'd like it to be. There are uncertainties in planetary orbits, for instance, or because there are certain things which are simply very difficult to model, like solar plasma and the effects of solar plasma on the propagation of the signal as it travels through the solar system, or atmospheric effects, in particular, the moisture content of the troposphere. And this is the precision that we are actually achieving here. And I like to stare at these numbers because we have a 2.29 gigahertz radio signal, which we are able to model with a roughly 2 millihertz precision over a time span of 20 years. That's 1 part in 10 to the 14 precision. If you compare that IEEE 64-bit floating point representation, that's 1 part in 10 to the 16. So we are pretty much at the limit of what double precision floating point can do. So we actually have to worry about computational noise, rounding noises in the algorithms. This is another source of noise. This is one of the original diagrams from Pioneer documentation. At the time of last contact, this was the signal level from Pioneer 10. That's less than 10 to the minus 21 watts. We are at the theoretical limit of what the deep space network can do, and at the theoretical limit of how much information you can communicate using a particularly weak signal. They really do need those receivers being cooled to 3 degrees Kelvin. Larry Kellogg once mentioned to me that he actually keeps getting emails from radio amateurs asking him, how can I contact Pioneer 10? How can I see the signal of Pioneer 10? So he has to explain to them that unless you actually have a 70-meter dish and a cryogenically cooled receiver, you just can't. It's impossible. It's simply impossible. This was actually one of the original diagrams from the design documentation. They pretty much expected signal loss here at around minus 165 dBm when the two spacecraft would have been just beyond Uranus's orbit. The reason why that signal loss didn't occur is because of the continuing upgrades of the deep space network, upgrading from 64-meter to 70-meter antennas, upgrading the receivers from 12 degrees Kelvin to 3 degrees Kelvin cooled receivers. It was in fact possible, and in fact in principle I believe it would have been possible to maintain communication with Pioneer 10 for an additional few years, perhaps up to like 2010. And that's absolutely incredible because if you think about it, that's an 8-watt transmitter. That's a flashlight. I mean, never mind it's radio waves, I mean it's electromagnetic. That's a flashlight. And we see that flashlight from 100 astronomical units. So as I said, there are many possible noise sources, and a lot of those noise sources are in fact systematic noises. And that makes something, that creates a difficult situation. If you're familiar with the 2002 JPL paper, there are a lot of details in that paper about the error of the acceleration and the magnitude of that error. And they give formal errors and they give realistic errors. Formal errors are something like 0.03 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. Realistic error is 1.74 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. So there's like a 2 orders of magnitude difference between, quote, formal and, quote, realistic errors. And there is really no, to me, satisfying explanation as to why these two errors are so different. Because if I have an error, whatever the cause, it should show up in the data. So any algorithm that is analyzing that data should be able to tell me what that error is, and I wouldn't have to resort to ad hoc arguments about computational noise and this error source and that error source to construct my realistic error estimate. It should come out straight from the algorithm. Why doesn't it? And I believe that the reason for that is the algorithms basically assume that all error is random and that all sample points are statistically independent. So when you have systematic error. Like, for instance, we mismodel the orbit of the Earth slightly, and as a result, we mismodel the positions of the deep space network stations slightly. That would be an example of a systematic error. That affects all data points equally, even though its cause may be a single number. So in these error calculations, you have to basically develop an approach to compute what would be the error degrees of freedom for this calculation. And that would not necessarily be the same as the number of degrees, as the number of data points, which is usually assumed to be the error degrees of freedom by the fitting algorithms. Unfortunately, it is very difficult to reliably estimate the error degrees of freedom in the data. There are certain approaches to do this, but the problem is that we are talking about a humongous data set that actually contains chunks of data because there have been observational periods and then there were gaps. So it's unevenly sampled data. And if you use any of the standard algorithms to attempt to discover the degree of autocorrelation in that data and to find the realistic degrees of freedom, error degrees of freedom in there, up to this date, I have not been able to find an approach that works reliably in the sense that it produces stable and reproducible results. But there is a good substitute. We know how many model parameters are there. And if I just say, you know what, I assume all the error is due to systematic errors, which means basically that the error degrees of freedom would be basically the number of model parameters. And I plug that in, lo and behold, I get those realistic errors that were constructed using an entirely different way by the authors of the 2002 paper. A realistic error that is roughly 2 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. Their official figure is 1.74 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. Now, if what I'm saying is correct, then that means that if we were to detune the model, and by detuning the model, I mean the following. We run the model and we determine the amount of anomalous acceleration. Okay, so we get a number. Now, I rerun the model, but I no longer treat that acceleration as a fitted parameter. I now intentionally change its value and fix it there. And let's see how good a residual do I get. I have a very interesting plot to show to you. This is the best fit acceleration, and these are various other values for the acceleration and the corresponding Doppler residual. And they follow a very, very neat curve. And this is to be expected. And when if I just very naively assume that, okay, this is the best fit that I'm able to achieve for reasons beyond my control, like our knowledge of the solar system and whatnot, and I say, okay, anything that's any error in the acceleration that does not exceed this in magnitude would have to be acceptable, because I can't tell the difference between noise due to mismodeling the solar system or noise due to mismodeling the acceleration. So that means that if I add these two as two independent sources of error, then I get root 2 times this one, and that's the horizontal line. And look at that. Once again, we are getting that realistic error that is reported in the JPL paper. So this suggests to me that from the Doppler data alone, using our current knowledge of the solar system and using the abilities of the deep space network, about plus or minus 2 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared is the best that we can obtain, or best that we can achieve in terms of acceleration accuracy. This is not a rigorous proof or anything. This is something I'm actually working on, but I believe that this actually is a sensible picture as to how good the data is. So, as I mentioned earlier, the right way to approach this problem is to build a comprehensive thermal model and then put that into the orbit estimation, updating the force model of the spacecraft with the thermal recoil force, and then use that to determine whether or not there is still a statistically significant residual remaining above and beyond what would be the minimum residual achievable, which means there is still an anomaly, or if there isn't, that means the anomaly is gone. So this would be the right way, but I have actually done it a number of other ways because I didn't always do as I preach. I participated in the recovery of the telemetry. I pretty much wrote all the code that is able to interpret that telemetry. I actually constructed a crude geometric model before moving the back of the envelope stuff, before moving on to something better. I actually constructed a ray tracing model that is much more sophisticated, but still not the kind of industrial strength finite element model that JPL uses for modern spacecraft. And I built my own independent orbit determination software to verify and confirm the existence of the anomaly. This was my early attempt at a geometric model. I actually got a number, a neat little number for the RTGs, that RTG heat is converted into a recoil force with an efficiency of about 0.9%. So that would mean for 2.5 kilowatts, that would mean about 20-25 watts of recoil force equivalent coming from the RTGs alone. So that would be about what, 40% of the Pioneer anomaly. In fact, I believe a few years ago, after one of the APS conferences, the Scientific American reported that according to Slava Turyshev, heat explains 30% of the anomaly. I was never able to verify exactly what it was that they were misreporting, but I suspect that it was something like this that Slava may have mentioned, that the RTGs account for about one-third of the anomaly, and the journalist mistook that as being an estimate for the entire thermal recoil force. This was my ray tracing model, and it gave some interesting numbers too. For the RTGs, we got around 1% once again. But with this model, I was beginning to be able to estimate torque as well. And torque is important because, as I mentioned, these spacecraft are spinning. But not only are they spinning, their spin rate is changing. And when you think about it, you leave a spacecraft out in deep space and it's spinning, there's absolutely no reason for its spin rate to change, because there is no way for it to to shed angular momentum. Nonetheless, these two spacecraft had a changing spin rate. This is Pioneer 10, very, very steady constant spin rate change until there was something that happened on board. And I say something because we never knew what it was, but there were anomalous readings in the fuel tank, pressure changes, temperature changes, and this anomalous period of a kind of a distinct period of a higher spin rate change, and then it resumed at the original rate. Contrary to what you may have read in the 2002 JPL paper, Pioneer 11's spin rate was going up. This was actually a very significant propulsion system malfunction from which the spacecraft recovered, and fortunately its spin rate did not exceed about, I believe, 8.5 revolutions per minute, at which point it would have exceeded the structural limits of the spacecraft. So they were able to, anyhow, 8 revolutions per minute, 60 divided by 8, I believe, is 7.5, that's 7.5 seconds per revolution. Very similar number, numerical value. And the 2002 paper actually had a plot that went like this and indicated the vertical axis as RPM. It wasn't RPM, it was seconds per revolution, so the inverse of RPM. So how can this be? How can the spin rate behavior of the two spacecraft be so different? And this is the answer. This is a close-up of the spin rate of Pioneer 11. And the vertical lines represent maneuvers that we were able to identify from the telemetry, and I suspect that there is also a maneuver here, but there was no indication of it in the telemetry, and there are many reasons why it may not have been recorded in the telemetry. I'm pretty sure this was too a maneuver. So what happens is that between maneuvers, the spin rate is decreasing at varying rates, and at the time of maneuvers, it jumps discontinuously. So what that probably means is that there was a thruster misalignment. So every time the spacecraft did a precession maneuver, one of the thrusters might have been slightly misaligned and added to the spin of the spacecraft. And the varying spin rate change between maneuvers is that we already knew that Pioneer 11 had faulty valves, and it had some significant fuel leaks. And varying amounts of fuel leaks account for the changing spin rate decrease between maneuvers. But once you look at this, you suddenly realize that the picture between the two spacecraft is consistent, after all. They both have a decreasing spin rate, but in the case of Pioneer 11, the picture is complicated by these issues of from its propulsion system. Actually, if I go back just 1 second. This is a sunshade for one of the instruments, and the reason why I actually modeled it is because you can see how it is affected by thermal radiation coming from one RTG, but the corresponding other RTG does not have a similar sunshade on the other side, so the spacecraft is asymmetric. And this actually accounts for a spin rate change very consistent with what I was showing to you. So in fact, a sufficiently detailed thermal model can not only reconstruct the recoil force of Pioneer 10 and 11, but may also explain the spin history of the two spacecraft. So let me go back. This is just a pretty picture from my own orbit determination code. And once again, if you plug in the initial state vector from the JPL ephemerides that is published on the JPL website, you actually get a pretty good fit because, again, I'm talking about a 2.3 gigahertz radio signal, and right there I get a fit that is no worse than about 5 hertz off. This was an 11-year time span. But then we go through the fitting exercise, and we get something like this, a horizontal line with vanishing residuals. So I was able to confirm the presence of the Pioneer anomaly with this software, of course. And I was also able to verify in different ways that linear relationship between the thermal power on board and the recoil force on board would actually stand. And I was able to use my software to either estimate those coefficients, or using those coefficients that were derived from a thermal model, estimate the residual. And either way, I'm getting a very consistent, self-consistent picture. So, after all that, I still have to tell you that I'm not satisfied, and it's still not good enough, because my model is insufficiently detailed. It's using an untested methodology. Basically, I invented it. and it's using untested software that has never ever been used for any other spacecraft. So the gold standard, if you wish, would be to reconstruct everything that I told you using JPL software that they have been using consistently for the last 40-some years with all their spacecraft. And that's the work that is currently underway. And I must apologize for not telling you some things about that work, because it would be very improper for me to disclose information that involves other people's research that has not been published yet. But that's the current effort that we are working on, and we are very close to actually publishing results. So I started my talk with a funny title from Donald Rumsfeld about knowns and unknowns, and it takes me to the biggest unknown that, in my mind, would remain the biggest uncertainty regardless of what results we are publishing. This issue, I believe, was first raised by Lou Schaffer in 2003 in his paper, where he basically said, wait a moment, you take those RTGs, they're covered by white paint, actually, and this is exposed to the sun. The spacecraft is launched, and it spends a significant amount of time in the 1 AU environment before it leaves the inner solar system and then gets beyond Jupiter and whatnot. It accumulates a humongous amount of solar irradiation. And we know that such paints actually suffer serious degradation, and in particular, their infrared properties can change quite significantly as a result of solar irradiation, primarily ultraviolet light from the sun. But this may actually be complicated. Well, first of all, there is solar electrons as well. But this may actually be complicated by the fact that these RTGs are hot, even on the outside. They are, like, I believe, 150, 160 degrees centigrade hot. And they are also exposed to a significant amount of neutron flux coming from the plutonium fuel. To make a long story short, nobody has any idea how this particular paint behaves under those circumstances in space. And similar paints, some of them go up, some of them go down. So there is no guidance either. And the infrared emissivities actually can change by as much as 5%. And the 5% change on the sun-facing elements of these RTGs, not accompanied by a similar change on the other surfaces of the RTGs, can result in an up to 50% uncertainty of the amount of in the acceleration of those RTGs. In the amount of acceleration that those RTGs alone contribute to the total thermal recoil force. And if I assume very crudely that the RTGs contribute to about one half of the thermal recoil force, that means that this problem represents a 25% uncertainty in the overall thermal recoil force, if calculated from a thermal model. And this basically dwarfs all other possible sources of error. So if we do an absolutely perfect job, then simply because we don't know the answer to this, this is the best that we can hope to achieve. Now, I'm putting these two numbers up because this really tells you exactly what is the best answer that we can possibly give. On the one hand, in terms of the Doppler-derived acceleration figures, again, roughly 2 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared error magnitude, and on the other hand, in terms of the magnitude of the thermal recoil force and its error. So because of this, because of these uncertainties, even though in my heart of hearts, I'm pretty sure it's thermal, I have to keep open the possibility that it's not, or at least not all of it is, because that's my most important message to you. Even if it turns out that thermal cannot fully account for the Pioneer anomaly, it is not as small a number as the 2002 JPL paper led you to believe. It is comparable in magnitude to the Pioneer anomaly. So even if it is more than 1 sigma away from the anomaly, it will account for, like, say, 70% of the 80% of the anomaly, 85% of the anomaly. So whatever remains will be much smaller. So this wonderful numerical coincidence, forget about it. Just gone. And also, as I indicated earlier, do not assume that you know that the anomaly is constant, and do not assume that you know that the anomaly is sunward pointing, because other alternatives produce equally good solutions. I included this because last year I had an interesting correspondence with a researcher called Carl Wolfman, who was test driving the idea of using essentially the outdated idea of a conformal cosmology to explain the Pioneer anomaly. I'm not buying into that idea. It is outdated. It long predates the discovery of the CMB. But the reason why it is interesting is because too many people have said that it cannot be cosmological because it has the wrong sign. that if it is cosmological expansion that is causing the pioneer anomaly, then it would be a redshift, not a blueshift. And the pioneer anomaly, as we know, is a blueshift. Now, this is an example when it would actually be a blueshift. Because if we live in a conformal universe, which would be represented here by the blue coordinate grid, a stationary distant star, as it sends its light to the observer at the origin, the observer would see that light being slightly redshifted. So there is the conformal explanation of the Hubble redshift. But when we do two-way Doppler with a moving spacecraft, there would be a redshift, of course, but because the units of time are increasing as a result of the conformal metric, this will actually appear slightly shorter than it would in the original coordinate system, resulting in an apparent blue shift. So this is one example when, in fact, it is possible to have a cosmologically cosmological origin or cosmological cause for a blue shift. Again, as I said, I'm not buying into this idea. I'm just saying that it is that we have to be very cautious when people dismiss ideas offhand, you know, like it can be because it has the wrong sign. Well, it can. I don't think it is, but that argument does not stand. These are three acceleration models: constant acceleration, linearly decaying acceleration, exponentially decaying acceleration. They are hard to distinguish because they are pretty much overlapping. They're all equally good. They all match the data. And as to the direction, about the only one I think I'm able to exclude is acceleration in the direction of the spacecraft's motion. Because for Pioneer 11, when it was traveling from Jupiter to Saturn, its direction of motion was, well, not quite perpendicular, but certainly at a significant angle from the sun direction or the Earth direction. But if we have a thermal recoil force that accounts for, say, 80% of the anomaly, and there's a remaining 20%, then I don't think even this can be excluded because the relative uncertainties become that much larger. So one of the things that we set out to do in the last few years was to determine the direction of the Pioneer anomaly. I don't think that based on the Doppler data alone, we can make a unique determination. And the reason for that is because these three directions are just within a few degrees of one another, especially during the outer part of the spacecraft's orbit. I believe the Sun-spacecraft-Earth angle is less than 2 degrees, for instance. So how can you tell the difference between those two directions? Now, one other thing I'd like to mention to you, again, I'm kind of responding to a number of papers that I've seen over the years and have been asked to critique. All the Pioneer Doppler observations that we use to postulate the existence of an anomaly are two-way or three-way Doppler observations. This would be one-way Doppler. If you had a precision oscillator on board sending a precision radio signal to the Earth. But we don't have a precision oscillator on board. What we do have is a radio subsystem on board that can receive a signal and send back a corresponding phase-logged coherent signal, coherent response. And they call it three-way Doppler when the transmitting and receiving stations are not the same, but as far as we are concerned, I think there really is no difference between these two because the deep space network can be considered as a single system. I have this pretty little diagram showing what two-way or three-way Doppler means. Imagine these two guys throwing ping-pong balls at the third guy, who then throws the ping-pong ball back. And they make measurements. They know how fast the ping-pong ball is traveling, they know how long it takes for them to receive a ping-pong ball, and from that increasing interval, they can determine the velocity of this guy who is throwing the ping-pong balls back. But the important thing is, if this guy's watch runs slow or fast, it doesn't matter. All he is doing, he's bouncing back ping-pong balls. He's not measuring anything with his watch. Again, I'm kind of responding to a number of papers that I've seen that attempted to explain the Pioneer anomaly by postulating various clock acceleration mechanisms on board the spacecraft. If you look at this diagram, I call this guy Peter, but might as well be Pioneer. Peter's watch can stop for all we care. So long as he bounces back all those ping pong balls promptly, we can make an accurate measurement here, because only these two guys' watches matter. Now, I have a more sophisticated diagram representing the same thing. This is how these Doppler measurements are being performed. I use these lines to represent the rather complicated word lines of the transmitting and receiving stations because they're situated here on the Earth doing the combined motion of Earth's rotation, orbit around the sun, etc., etc. We make a measurement. between two well-determined points of time along the light cone of the along the word line of the receiving station. Now, in the model, we project that that measurement back along light cones onto the word line of the spacecraft, and then we project that back onto the word line of the transmitting station. So we now know exactly the two points in time that correspond to these two points in time at the receiver. We know the transmitting frequency, so we know exactly how many pulses were sent during this time interval. That must match what we observed here. If they don't match, we have a Doppler residual. That's the Pioneer anomaly, that mismatch. So, again, yet another issue. Again, a number of solutions, proposed solutions that I saw about the Pioneer anomaly did boil down to some effect that affected the radio signal. And ultimately, it had to do with either the duration of time that it took for that signal to arrive or the length of the path that that signal traversed. But the problem with that is that the geocentric velocity and the geocentric distance of the spacecraft are not simple, constant, or monotonous functions. The geocentric velocity of the spacecraft varies between minus 20 and plus 40 kilometers per second as a result of the Earth's orbital motion. And similarly, the geocentric distance of the spacecraft is decreasing part of each year. And this is what it looks like. This line, wavy line, is the geocentric spacecraft, the distance of Pioneer 10 in astronomical units. This is the geocentric velocity of the spacecraft in kilometers per second. So any explanation that attempts to derive something from the length of the path or the duration of the time that the signal travels is doomed, in my opinion, because the velocity is not constant and the distance is not monotonously increasing, and these are just not consistent with the nature of the anomaly and the Doppler residual. This is Pioneer 11. It actually shows this was the time period when it was traveling from Jupiter to Saturn. And finally, all too often I've seen papers that simply ignore the fact that we know the solar system pretty well. In particular, we know Saturn's orbit quite well because of Cassini and the radio science from Cassini. So whatever solution is being proposed, be it modified gravity or cosmology or something else, must leave those orbits alone, because otherwise it would simply not fit a large body of established data from the solar system. And again, I'm mentioning this because I've seen too many papers where people simply ignored the fact that we have such knowledge of the solar system. Lastly, I would like to mention something about the infamous onset. You may have heard that the early data supposedly shows that the Pioneer anomaly appeared shortly after, I believe, the encounter with Saturn. However, that apparent mismodeling can also be a result of something, that apparent onset can also be a result of a rather innocuous mismodeling. And what I mean is, back in 1972, they did not have sophisticated finite element software to do a detailed thermal model of the spacecraft. Instead, they had some vague ideas of what it would do, then they launched it, and then they used the initial radio science measurements to calibrate the solar pressure model of the spacecraft while it was already in flight. Now, suppose there was an anomaly that they didn't know about, and they calibrated that into the solar pressure model by accident. This is what they would get. And that's exactly what the onset looks like. Now, that doesn't mean that I proved that this is the cause of the onset. It simply means that given the uncertainties of the solar pressure model, I can simply make the onset disappear by recalibrating the solar pressure model of the spacecraft, and I'm still consistent with everything I know about the Pioneer spacecraft. So my message on this one is that the onset is probably just a red herring issue. At 6 AU, which is beyond the orbit of Jupiter, the spacecraft was still receiving over 200 watts of solar heating. So compare that to the 65 watts of the Pioneer anomaly. I also mentioned the flyby anomaly, once again, because a number of people have been trying to make a connection between the two. But again, I don't think such a connection exists, because the flyby anomaly is very different in nature from the Pioneer anomaly. If it is a real anomaly, it is effectively an instantaneous velocity change at perigee. But I'm just parroting what I was told by smart people, that it is quite possibly just a modeling artifact, which I believe has to do a great deal with the fact that most spacecraft orbit determination is being done in a solar system barycentric reference frame. But when they do the flyby, the inner part of the flyby is actually done in a geocentric reference frame, which is an accelerating reference frame. And the switcheroo between these two reference frames can actually introduce artifacts. And I was told, again, I'm parroting what I'm being told. It's not something that I have verified firsthand. But quite possibly, this switcheroo is the root cause of the apparent flyby anomaly, and it may not even be real. But in any case, even if it is, I don't think it has anything to do with the Pioneer anomaly. And last but not least, could the Pioneer anomaly be verified by other spacecraft? I wish it could have been, because New Horizons, like Pioneer, is a spinner. It has an RTG on board. And it was in hyperbolic deep space trajectory, it still is, traveling towards Pluto. If they had the money, they could have done the precision Doppler tracking, and we would have Doppler data. They didn't, and now that opportunity is forever lost. At the very least, we no longer have the opportunity to confirm whether or not this onset is a real effect, because it's way beyond Jupiter now, way beyond Saturn's orbit. But I haven't heard anything that there would be any precision Doppler tracking in any case, so it's gone. Voyagers performed several maneuvers each day. Because of that, there is huge maneuver noise, and they're useless. There are some other spacecraft, Galileo, Cassini, Ulysses, but none of them yielded the kind of data that Pioneer 10 and 11 yielded. So for the foreseeable future, Pioneer 10 and 11 is the best data that we will have, probably in the lifetime of anyone in this room. That's the best data that we will have as a deep space gravitational experiment from the outer parts of the solar system. And it would have been absolutely marvelous if that data unambiguously showed a deviation from Einstein gravity. But personal opinion, I think it was just a wild goose chase. However, there are still lessons to be learned. We know exactly how precisely we can navigate a spacecraft. That plus or minus 2 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. That limit seems to come not from limitations of the spacecraft, but from limitations of our knowledge of the environment in which that spacecraft flies. So it's probably a limit that would apply to other spacecraft. The importance of preserving 40-year-old mission data, because we are still discovering new things from the original raw data, and if that raw data had not been available, that opportunity would have been lost forever. And the dangers of doing things on the back of an envelope, especially when those things involve such minuscule quantities that are so much beyond everyday experience, they can just mislead. So that's about it. I hope you found this useful and I was able to tell you something new. I did put in some references here. I would like to call attention to this paper, which was published just in September, Living Reviews in Relativity, Slava Turishev and myself. It's, I believe, a very comprehensive review of the Pioneer anomaly and also the literature. And I also put in some additional references, which in my opinion are the key papers that were either the original discovery papers, confirmation papers, or other key papers that added something of relevance. That's about it. Thank you very much for your attention. Any questions? That's easy.
I don't know. I know next to nothing about this subject, but like, just out of interest, like how far from the Earth was the Pioneer when this anomaly was first detected?
When it was first detected, actually, you know what? I think I can tell you exactly because I have the diagram. Yeah. This first early data point is about 6 astronomical units. Most of the real data we have is from this region, so 15 to 20 onward. And there is an overlap between the two spacecraft, which is preserved in the present day data as well. The farthest data point we have from Pioneer 10 is about, I'd say, about 80 astronomical units, so way out.
Earth is 1 astronomical unit. So 6 times.
This would be. I believe Jupiter is at 5 astronomical units from the Earth, from the Sun.
Okay.
This is heliocentric distance, by the way.
So I want to ask about practicalities. You recovered a lot of the early tapes.
Yes.
And so on. What were the challenges in recovering
tapes? Well, there are two distinct data sets. One is telemetry. The other is Doppler. The telemetry data, back in the 1990s, for reasons that nobody remembers anymore, the tapes were actually copied to magneto-optical disks. And then in the mid-2000s, Larry Kellogg, using his own laptop and own spare time, before that old VAX, mini-VAX, that micro-VAX that was able to read these optical disks was trashed, he actually copied everything over to his laptop and onto modern DVDs. So that was essentially a monolithic data set. The Doppler data was a much more complicated endeavor. They literally went high and low. I wasn't involved directly in that search. Most of that search was done at JPL. Some of that search was actually done by Craig Marquardt in his own spare time. Craig Marquardt is working at NASA Goddard, and he is a member, I believe, of the SWIFT team. But he was doing it in his own spare time. Finding old tapes in the NASA archives, recovering the data from those tapes, and converting the data. One thing that complicated it is that during these decades, several different navigational formats were used by NASA software. And the conversion programs no longer existed, and it's very difficult to find documentation documenting the old formats. Even worse, some of the tapes that Craig Marquardt was able to recover were actually converted ones using faulty software that introduced a corrupt bit into every record. And because of that, the data appeared to be completely unusable, but Craig was able to identify that corrupt bit and was able to recover the data. Yet a further complication is that not too long after Pioneer 10 and 11 were launched, JPL invented this idea or this technique called ramping. And ramping basically means is that the transmitter on ground is no longer using a constant frequency, but it is in fact using a frequency that varies as a function of time, usually just a linear function of time. I believe the main reason why this was invented, I believe actually there were two reasons. One is that during a planetary encounter, like I showed you the diagram and Pioneer 11 makes that 90-degree turn. I mean, think about it. That spacecraft is moving at several 10 kilometers per second, and it makes a 90-degree turn in a few hours. I mean, it is experiencing over 1G of gravitational acceleration, humongous acceleration, and that means that its Earth's relative velocity is changing very rapidly. So there was concern that they would not be able to track such a rapidly changing signal frequency, so they were trying to compensate for that by varying the transmitter frequency to make sure that whatever they are getting, that first of all, the spacecraft is able to maintain a lock on the Earth's transmitter, and that the Earth receivers were able to maintain a lock on the received signal from the spacecraft. So that was one reason. The other reason, I believe, was the well-documented onboard failure of Voyager 2. Voyager 2 had an onboard failure in its receiver. Essentially, I believe it was down to a faulty capacitor. The receiver remained operational, but as a result of this failure, its frequency range tremendously narrowed. And because of that, in order to be able to maintain communication with that spacecraft, they basically implemented this ramping technique of trying to follow this frequency exactly so they are hitting the right frequency when they're transmitting to the spacecraft. Even today, if you read on the NASA website, the Voyager status reports, every week you read something like this. Nothing happens, and so it says something like, a command lost timer reset command was sent to Voyager 1, the spacecraft confirmed the command. Then next, Voyager 2. 6 command lost timer resets were sent at 0.5 hertz intervals, and 3 through 5 were received and confirmed by the spacecraft. So even today, they have to use this technique, and out of that 6, only like 3 of them are actually received by the spacecraft because its receiver had such a narrow frequency range. So this is the reason why this ramping was invented. But this ramping has been used routinely since. But that means that there is a very curious practical difficulty. The old navigational formats implicitly assumed that the transmitter had a constant frequency. So the navigational record recorded the constant frequency of the nominal frequency of the transmitter relative to which the signal has to be interpreted, but not when it was ramped. And the ramp records were generated separate from the spacecraft data record. dates and were stored on separate dates and whatnot. So a lot of the effort, I understand, at JPL went into recovering the appropriate, or reconstructing even, the RAMP records. And by reconstructing, I mean finding old DSN station documentation to find out exactly how the transmitter was RAMPed on that day or something, in order to find out what was the transmitting frequency on that particular day. So I believe, by the way, that we pretty much recovered everything there is to recover. There are gaps in the data, but the gaps in the data, I would say, again, this is my personal opinion, but I would say that most of the gaps, almost all of the gaps, are probably due to the fact that simply these two spacecraft were not tracked continuously with two-way Doppler. Curious thing, in 2006, when they attempted the last contact with the Pioneer 10, obviously they were trying to use the Goldstone 70-meter antenna at maximum power to maximize the chances of making contact with the spacecraft. Well, that Goldstone antenna is capable of transmitting at 400 kilowatts. Now, this is a 70-meter dish with an extremely well-focused 400-kilowatt beam. So you have to coordinate with the FAA, with the military, to make sure you're not hitting a passenger aircraft with that microwave beam, or you're not hitting a satellite with that microwave beam. So there are these practical issues, not to mention that these deep space network antennas are a limited resource, and that means that many other projects compete for them, and there may be project emergencies and whatnot that require the DSN resources. So there's no such thing as continuous tracking. So the data will have gaps, even if we recovered every lost record. So I believe that what has been recovered is pretty much a complete record. And we have Pioneer 10 data going from, I believe, late 1979 or early 1980 all the way to 2003 with gaps. So that's huge. The 2002 JPL study only covered 11.7 years of Pioneer 10 data, and now we have like close to 23 years. And by the way, there are no surprises in there. So.
General questions, comments. Is it going to be possible to do a more accurate gravitational experiment in the solar system?
My opinion is not at our present level of knowledge of the solar system. What you need to know, well, let me assume an ideal world, you know, in unlimited funding. You can get rid of atmospheric effects by placing the equivalent of a deep space network in deep space. Why do the antennas have to be on the surface of the Earth? Well, for cost reasons, I mean. But the problem is that they are sitting deep in the Earth's atmosphere, and especially at these frequencies, the propagation velocity of the signal is very significantly affected by the moisture content of the atmosphere and also the state of the ionosphere to a lesser extent. So that actually complicates things, but this can be eliminated by placing the Earth station, not on the Earth, but in space. Okay, suppose you do that. You still have very significant uncertainties coming from solar plasma. There are charged particles streaming from the sun all the time, and they vary by orders of magnitude, the amount of charged particles. And that can affect the propagation velocity of the signal quite significantly. And that is in fact, when I showed to you I'm not going to search for it now, but when I showed to you the residuals plot, those unavoidable peaks arise as a result of the spacecraft visually traveling near the sun, I mean, being near conjunction with the sun. And that's the effect of solar plasma. That's basically mismodeled or unmodeled. Well, we do model solar plasma, but those models are, by necessity, averages and assumptions and not actual data. So our lack of knowledge of the solar plasma, solar wind, and our lack of knowledge of the orbits of planets and G times M for the sun, I believe, is known to about 10 decimal digits of precision. G times M for the smaller planets is known to a lesser precision. Then especially like the planetary environments, you know, the numerous moons of Jupiter and Saturn and all that, they all contribute, depending, of course, on where the spacecraft is. So until, well, you have seen all those papers from Lorenzo Iorio, where he's trying to do precision stuff from the Pityava analysis of JPL and Russian solar system ephemeris data. But I've also heard that criticized because apparently it ignores a number of possible error sources, and the data is simply not as accurate as they are trying to believe or trying to suggest. So that roughly 2 meters per second, 2 times 10^-10 meters per second squared uncertainty, the primary causes for that uncertainty are these three, and probably in this order: solar plasma, solar system ephemerides, and the Earth atmosphere. Of these, you can eliminate the Earth atmosphere, but to eliminate the other two, well, you could. What we could do, for instance, is fly something like the equivalent of the Apollo mirrors onto every planet and every moon, and do laser imaging. Once you have that, you have sub-centimeter knowledge of the entire solar system, and you eliminated that problem, so the only one that remains is solar plasma, and that can be mitigated by choosing better frequencies, not the 3.2 gigahertz frequency of Pioneer, but higher frequencies. So, in principle, I guess, yes, you could probably, with 22nd century science, you could probably do an order of magnitude better, or even with 21st century science, but with unlimited funding.
And the other point is that if you, so that means if you have a modified gravity field, a couple on the market, one of this mine, it has to fit the solar system data.
It must.
Means it has to agree with Einstein to a high degree of accuracy, and Newton, obviously.
Yeah.
Secondly, this is not the case out there in the universe. Because at present, dark matter is postulated in order to compensate for some serious problems with Einstein gravity.
Yes.
Newtonian gravity, galaxies, clusters, cosmology. No one's ever detected dark matter. Potentially no one ever will. So we have a serious problem here. And that's it for gravity for a long time.
Yeah, like you said, in the solar system, we have extremely precise confirmation of Einstein gravity. And the one experiment that may have disproved not only Einstein, but even Newton, because again, the Pine anomaly, if it is due to new physics, it would be at the Newtonian level, not the PPN level. But as I said, you heard my opinion. I believe it's a wild goose chase. I believe it is mechanical in origin. So, other than that, everything that we did in the solar system confirms Einstein to ever better accuracy. On the other hand, you go out to the Milky Way, and suddenly, unless you postulate the existence of dark matter, the postulate that cannot at this time be independently verified or corroborated, Einstein gravity fails by an order of magnitude. I guess that's the big dilemma. That's why modified gravity, I believe, still has a legitimate place in the discussion. And the one troubling aspect, by the way, is that the error I mentioned to you, 2 × 10^-10 meters per second squared, it is annoyingly higher than the famous A0 of Mott, which is roughly 1.2 × 10^-10 meters per second squared. Close, but higher. So, which means, you know, like, I'm not much of a fan of Mott, as you know, but for Mond, it basically means they can hide in the noise.
Just your opinion, so I take it, is that the flyby anomalies are equally explainable by the
kind of... I basically parroted to you what I heard from people at JPL. It's not my opinion in the sense that it is not something I know as intimately, but based on what I do know about orbital modeling, it is an entirely plausible thing that they said. And again, my attitude with respect to this is that when you contrast conventional physics with new physics, if conventional physics is plausible, which means it cannot be excluded, end of story, because there is no room for new physics. In order to have new physics, you first have to unambiguously exclude conventional physics. Otherwise, you have no case. So before you can talk about new physics, you must be able to say that I have tested every possible conventional hypothesis, and none of them and no combination of them agree with the data, which means that I must resort to new physics. And that was, in a sense, my attitude problem with respect to Pioneer, that I'm not against new physics. Quite the contrary, I very much like the idea of new physics. But discipline dictates that you cannot do that before you exclude the conventional explanations. And my reaction to Slavatoriša's revelation in 2005 that there is no detailed thermal model for Pioneer 10 was a reaction of shock, precisely because up until that time I thought that conventional causes were rigorously excluded, and that's why we have the discussion of possible non-conventional causes for the Pioneer anomaly. So when I found out that they weren't, well, and basically what I'm reporting to you here is work in progress, but work in progress that very much indicates that in the end, no rigorous study will be able to exclude the conventional cause, and as far as I'm concerned, that means end of story. And the same thing would probably apply to the flyby anomaly as well. If it is reanalyzed properly, if this issue of switching between solar system barycentric and geocentric reference frames is addressed and other possible issues are addressed, for all intents and purposes, it will probably go away.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.